Eufy is sponsoring today's video. They reached out to me. I tested out their video lock. It is a game changer. I'm going to paint a picture for you for why I'm so excited to work with them. So you're getting home, your arms are loaded with groceries or packages or boxes or everything, and your keys are in your pocket. This drives me nuts. This happens all the time. I upgraded to the Eufy video lock, fingerprint, tap, I'm inside. And honestly, I also feel way safer. It's got this awesome built-in camera. So whether it's a package delivery or late night Uber order, I see exactly who's there right from my phone. There are no more mystery knocks. And the best part, this thing was such a breeze to set up. There's no wires, there's no drilling. There's also no monthly subscription fees. So if you are done fumbling with your keys, because I definitely am, search for Eufy Video Lock or head over to eufyofficial.com/video lock. Your front door, your sanity. Welcome to Success Story, the most useful podcast in the world. I'm your host, Scott D. Clary. The Success Story podcast is part of the HubSpot Podcast Network. The HubSpot Podcast Network has other great podcasts like Marketing Made Simple, hosted by Dr. JJ Peterson. Marketing Made Simple brings you practical tips to make your marketing easy and, more importantly, make it work. Now, if any of these topics sound interesting to you, you're going to love his show. How to write and deliver captivating speeches, how to market yourself into a new job, how design can help and potentially hurt your revenue, and how to create a social media ad strategy that works. If these topics hit home and they're things that you want to learn about, go listen to Marketing Made Simple wherever you get your podcasts. Today, you're going to hear an episode of my new podcast, Liquidity and Liquor. I co-host Liquidity and Liquor with Yosef Martin, a serial entrepreneur who sold his last company, BoxyCharm, for over $500 million. On Liquidity and Liquor, we have conversations about business, money, and life with some of the most interesting people in the world. You can download and subscribe to Liquidity and Liquor on YouTube or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, John, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Joe.
Are you excited?
I'm super excited.
You should cry.
I actually don't know what I'm excited about, but yeah, I'm stoked.
So those who don't know, that guy right here is a good friend for 7 years, right? We've been friends for seven years.
I'm so sorry.
Sorry for you. We work together in the EO group, which is Entrepreneur Organization. We actually, you knew about me before because
we did a lot of things. I don't know how much we were working, but...
And then you exit your company, and I'm jumping, all right, you exit your company called Shipmunk. Not exit, you sold a piece of your company, Shipmunk, at a very high multiple. It was a very high multiple, nine-figure multiples, about a month after I did, right, or so. In 2020, we both kind of like cashed out nice. And the difference between you and I is that you're 29, you motherfucker. And all those years when you're running the company, all I remember is I am right now in a safari trip. I am right now snowboarding in Japan. I was there breaking my back. And so I think it would be awesome to hear how do you leverage lifestyle, doing everything. We're going to talk about a lot of his lifestyle, guys.
Oh my God.
Yeah. While he was selling his business at the kind of like the interesting time in our life during COVID. So welcome to the show.
Thanks, Joe. Appreciate it.
Well, I'm learning about it for the first time, so I don't know what you got done together.
Well,
what kind of adventures you've been on.
So I want to say about my thing with John, right? So John started Shipmunk, which is a fulfillment logistic company, right? Filling up and packaging everything, going after the small companies that wanted to ship up their goods online, right? And he had probably the most creative method I've seen, kind of 2.0 type of shipping companies, where the rest of them are very old school, silverhead industry, where all of them are, you come over to the office, they don't even give you a glass of water because they're very technical. They talk to you about what they're doing. When you go to Shipmunk, it's kind of like you're going into a little party, an event. You need to see his location, and everything was geared towards experience for the consumer, something they didn't do. And you're a kid, you're going into FIU, FAU, international student.
When did you start? Because I was even doing a little bit of research, and you built Shipmunk off like a 30K
award. So like the whole backstory, you know, I moved here in 2008 and then went to high school, played hockey for 2 years, got a scholarship, and then moved to FAU. And I started the first business, which was similar to what Shipmunk is, but something different, where we're buying products in the US and shipping them internationally. So you know, got a little bit of my feet wet in logistics and e-com. And this was back like 2010. I kind of started doing it first for friends, eventually for kind of other people. And then 2014, I graduated and I won a business plan competition with like 27K of awards and prizes. And got accepted to an accelerator program also at FAU. And so they gave me like a free warehouse space for a year. An additional, I think, 25K. So like by the time I graduated and was going to launch this thing, I had maybe like 70K in award prizes and this warehouse space for a year, which just kind of was like an amazing runway to start a business with. Because I was deciding like, okay, do I want to take the risk and, you know, do business full time, or do I like try to go to work and like start a business on the side, you know? And so the 70K kind of gave me enough confidence that I can try to do this without like going to work and, you know, trying to do both. So,
but why logistics? Like, how did you, okay, so you have 70K, like, was it part of a competition? It was like a case study?
So it was, yeah, no. So the competition was a business plan competition. So I was basically pitching, what I was doing is like, you know, if you lived in Europe and like you wanted to buy, I don't know, some specialized like clothing that wasn't really selling in Europe, right? Or they weren't shipping internationally. This was 2014, so a lot of companies didn't ship internationally. It was too complicated, it took too long. So we would basically provide the service of, we'll buy it for you, and then we'll sell it, you know, we'll ship it over to Czech, let's say, and then like you'll have this product, right? We would give them an address in the US, essentially, and then forward it over. So that was kind of the original concept. And with the business plan competition, the pitch was, we'll take all that, put kind of an automated platform on it, and then make it global. So like we don't just service Czech, but we service everybody. So that's how, you know, when I graduated, I basically like went on, hired like a developer and started building this platform. And then, you know, in the first year, somebody basically called me up and they're like, hey, you have this warehouse. We read about you in the newspapers. Like, can you do fulfillment for us? Mm-hmm. And so it kind of, you know, and I started looking at it and I didn't really know what fulfillment was. And I was like, well, there's a big gap in the market for SMB mid-market fulfillment needs, right? Because everybody
still in 2014.
This is 2014, yeah, like okay. Early 15.
And explain like what the landscape was like. Because so, now it seems so easy.
Now there's a lot of competition, yeah, right? Yeah. But back in 2014, there was maybe one company that was servicing like the SMB market. Because also remember,
what was
like,
that one company?
It's called Shipwire. They got acquired.
Shipwire.
Yeah, they got acquired by Ingram Micro in 2013. Okay. So the landscape, like if you think about like Shopify and like all these, you know, businesses that were starting online, that whole era of these entrepreneurs starting an online D2C brand really started around like 2010-11 with Shopify actually probably creating the best platform for that. So all these like old school logistics companies, they kept working with like much bigger players, and it was a lot easier to manage, you know, 4 or 5 clients in a warehouse than 200-300. So nobody really wanted to get in because it was too complex. There was no software, there was no processes, like it was very complicated. And so we didn't really know what we're getting into, but it's like, well, nobody's doing it or they're doing it terribly wrong. So let me try to get in that space and figure out how we can do it better. So we started building that solution to say, we can service, you know, 300 customers in a building or 500 customers in a building, built our own software to run the warehouse, our own software to kind of provide the order management, inventory management system to clients, and kind of connect the two tiers, and then ultimately, you know, provide a service that at the time, not many companies were providing. And the other piece was, like Joe said, right, like all these companies are old school logistics companies. So it's like they're run by, you know, like 50 plus year old dudes that just are not like fun. They don't speak the same language as like most of these e-commerce founders that are millennials, that very marketing brands driven. So we, you know, built a cool brand around Chipmunk, got a more millennial, you know, we wanted to kind of give this vibe of Zen, right? Which is why we picked the monk as kind of our logo, as our mantra, and wanted to create a whole experience just a lot more modern, right? From the office space to, you know, any interactions with our people, like anything, it was trying to be like different. It was trying to be more of, these are the people that speak the same language, not like, you know, it's like my grandfather classmates that are like running this company, right? And that's kind of the vibe that a lot of these other companies had.
Okay, makes sense. So when you first launched this, you said, okay, so you have like whatever, $70,000, you have warehousing. I guess somebody found out about what you were doing and then sort of prompted you to go down this route and build this out. And that was like one customer. But how did you find your first customers for the business? Like, what was it?
Yeah, so it was, so the first customer was the most random connection. Like, there was an article that came out
about
us.
That's the person that called you up and was like, hey, can you do this for me?
Yeah, so exactly. So it was a company out of Fort Lauderdale, actually. They raised $2 million to build like smart home products for Apple. And so, yeah, so like this guy calls me up and he's like, hey, my CEO's wife read an article about you in the newspaper and my CEO wants to support local business. Mm-hmm. like, we should work together. And, you know, I didn't really know what he wanted because we didn't work with US companies at the time. So I met with him. He basically told me, like, hey, we've had a terrible experience with our previous company and, like, we want to support you and work with you. So that was, like, the first customer that even, like, explained what the space is like. And, you know, I went and met with them and I was like, man, this is going to sound great. But they were, like, a year away from launching their product. So in the meantime, I started more, researching the space. And I went to a couple of trade shows to really figure out, like, okay, maybe I can talk to a couple of customers to see if they can use us. I went to CES in Vegas, which is like a consumer electronics show, because they just seemed to be like a logical place. And I basically just was like telling people, like, hey, you guys need fulfillment. There's plenty of startups in that like little startup section. And so I closed maybe like first five customers. Like most of these guys barely
you didn't have
started.
A process built.
I didn't have anything. No, like I didn't even like know how I'm going to do this. Right. Like I was like, oh, we have a warehouse in Florida and like we're doing this for plenty of brands. I mean, it was like fake it till you make it that game for sure. We're like, we have this amazing software.
Did you sign the deal at the time with that warehouse?
I already was in the warehouse, part of that accelerator program, right? Oh. But it was like thousands square feet.
Did you sign the customers?
So okay. So going through
this A thousand square feet.
Yeah. I mean, it's like this office. Exactly. And my mindset was like, hey, well, I'll get the customers. I'll figure out how we're going to do this later.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what we did. I came back from the show. I had probably five customers that I signed up. Most of them decided to ship us inventory without ever seeing what the warehouse looks like, right? I remember I had one customer that would come to visit and I would put, because it was a 1,000 square foot cage inside of a big building. So I put like fake boxes, like empty Amazon boxes that just built to take off the tape and just put them on the shelf so it looks like there's some product.
I think that's how Costco started. They had empty space and they put empty boxes on top.
Just to make it look like you're actually functioning
business?
Yeah, make
it look like they have stuff. Yeah.
That's really funny.
But I mean, it's like, well, because you want to... I mean, that's the scariest thing, right? Like you finally get a customer, they want to come visit to make sure you're real.
Yeah.
You're not really real. Like, how do you do? Like, how do you tell them like to give you confidence? And we did it. I kind of sold the guy on the fact that like, hey, I'll be the one basically shipping your stuff. And he ended up signing up, even though we had really nothing to sell at the time. And that's ultimately how it kind of started. So like I signed up the first five customers. Then I brought in one of my college buddies to basically do commission only sales. He would just call people.
This is like a super scrappy, super scrappy startup.
Very scrappy. I mean, it was like, and then this guy was just making commission only, right?
Yeah.
And we didn't, I didn't know any revenue models or anything like that would even tell me like how much you paid this guy. And so we just figured out some numbers and, we didn't have our target customer. Like we didn't know anything. So I bought a list for like $100 from my one of my friends. It was like a list of medical device companies because we just thought maybe medical devices would be like a cool thing to do, which by the way, medical devices are, even today, we don't ship medical devices because they're so complex and like you need all these like requirements, regulations.
Yeah. Yeah.
You need like all these certifications, like ISOs, and you're like, wow, like we spent like a couple hundred grand on compliance like now. And that was the first target customer that we went after. Like just that's how naive we were. But he was just dialing these guys in, like calling every single one of them and trying to see like, hey, do you guys need fulfillment? And he did end up landing, two, three customers. And like, it was a very slow progression from that point. Like we just signed up one, two customers, but because e-commerce was in such an inflection point at the time, like a lot of these brands, you'd sign them up, they were doing 100 orders a month. And then suddenly they would like skyrocket to like 500, right? The next month and 1,000 the next month. And so organically, as the brands we were onboarding were growing, like we were growing with them. So it was kind of a mutual, just there was a huge benefit of they're growing, we're growing, we're onboarding.
You feel like there was a renaissance for the online sales throughout, I don't know, from 2013 because of social media, 2013 all the way to, I would say, 2020. And then 2021, collapse of some sort of a correction for that renaissance.
Yeah, I mean, I for sure. I mean, I think it opened up the opportunities for anybody to start an e-com company, right? In 2013, I mean, you didn't really need a lot of money to do it. Like, could buy any white label product or got an idea for product, right? Build it. Shopify would allow you to have the front end of it. We would allow you to have the back end of it. And like, anybody could launch a brand within a couple months, right? And everybody wanted to do it because it's cool. And there's all these great success stories of people, starting out of their garage, building million-dollar businesses and like basically working from home and like not having to have massive teams. And we were definitely riding that wave where, you like brands like yours, right? Like it was just such a great time for that.
It was a great time to be alive and actually do it because I just saw a billboard where it says, Richard, the owner of Fashion Nova, sent me this billboard that says, 100 million orders just sold. Thank you, Fashion Nova, by Shopify. That shows you that a multi-billion dollar brand works with Shopify. Shows that when you want to launch a business, you don't have to worry about infrastructure anymore. You don't have to worry about logistic infrastructure because you have the Shipmunk. You don't have to worry about building your own website. You have Shopify. And if you're a small business all the way to a multi-billion dollar, you can still work with Shopify. So the ability to, but it was more about supply and demand, how many people are going to come fast enough before it's too late to go through that door.
And the challenge is like, you know, especially with what's happened with iOS 14 and like the challenge in advertising, right? Like during COVID, obviously the cost per acquisition for all these brands went zero, basically to nothing, right? Because everybody was buying online. Yeah. Nobody was spending on ads, like no travel. Like obviously a lot of these other industries just went to totally away. And so these brands just got really spoiled with like, man, we're, you know, it's costing us $3 to acquire a customer. And then things started normalizing, 21, right? Yeah. And it started to, like other people started advertising, which then naturally already increased the cost. But then you had this huge, you know, shift in the targeting, which just became even more difficult to ultimately get the same return. So, like, we have examples of brands whose cost per acquisition, you know, went up 10x, 20x.
Okay, so this is what I've heard. I've heard that in 2022, that if you have positive ROAS on your first customer, you're a unicorn.
Yeah.
Because it's so rare. So that's what the e-com environment is dealing with right now. So that means you have to have, like, your LTV on that customer has to be significant.
Yeah.
And you have to have, and also the attribution is all screwed up because of iOS too, right?
Exactly. So,
I mean, like,
it's never really accurate. Yeah.
It's never really accurate. Now there's actually tools that will somewhat replicate the accuracy. I can't remember the name of it now, but there are some e-com tools that try and replicate the accuracy of like pre-iOS update Facebook. But yeah. I mean, Google's pretty much all you have,
right,
for accuracy in terms of attribution, right?
No, and it's you know, it's I think what's happened, right, and like we're kind of seeing it because we have a pretty broad customer base. I mean, we got, I would say, you know, 1,500, 2,000 brands that we work with. They range from small, like one person, 10, 20, 50 orders a month shop, all the way to our largest, you know, is you know, 200 million. Well, now actually we sign up even larger ones, but like $500 million brands that, you know, will do hundreds of thousands of orders, right? So we have a pretty wide range of companies. And I think where you see the biggest impact is the ones that have been solely relying on social media for acquisition have been getting obviously hit the hardest. Now, the other challenge that you throw into this is this whole supply chain delay issue where, you know, during COVID, like nobody could get their stuff in. So everybody over inventory.
You feel it gets stabilized now?
It's getting better. It's definitely not stable yet. So
not stable
container, I mean, all the transportation pricing is coming down on the ocean and air freight. Like, you know, where it used to be, what, 24K for container, now that's coming down, like, pretty significantly.
16? Or
I think now it's like, 16, 15. You know, it used to be.
Before that, it was 4-5.
Three, sometimes, 5.
Yeah.
But it's getting better, but it's still not there. But the problem is, like, everybody, because they got so kind of, they got their asses handed to them in like 2020 because all their inventory was sitting in the water while they needed it, you know, for peak. Then 21, they got all the inventory, but they weren't selling as much, right? Yeah. And that's happening in 22 as well. So right now, like everybody has all this inventory, but they're not really selling, which is, you know, inventory is finance, so it's costing them money. So that's kind of hitting their bottom line. So even the brands that we work with that have been super profitable, doing really well this year, they're just having really like
tough time,
major tough time, financial challenges, right? And it's, you know, over inventory.
What's the challenge now for you outside of the supply chain issues? I mean,
I was going to say, do you have to like change your, like your ICP, your ideal customer profile? Do you have to like audit your customers a little bit better so that
just challenging your business?
Yeah. Well, I mean, so I think, scaling has always been a challenge, right? Like when you grow, you know, we've grown to, we're 2,500 people now. So like in 5-6 years, I've grown to 2,500 people. That in itself just,
how many locations?
19 warehouses.
Now. You have 19 warehouses now.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
In like 11 locations.
So what's the average size of a warehouse?
I mean, I don't know, in an average, we have 3.5 million square feet.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, it just depends on the market, but you know, I would say the biggest challenge is just making sure that as you grow, like you continue to stay agile and like be able to make quick decisions and the team scales with the growth. So like we're opening this year, I think we opened 3-4 new buildings and getting the team set up so that they can operate pretty quickly, right? Getting all the equipment ordered, getting the training done, getting everything kind of up and running. That's a really challenging piece because, you know, you're trying to deal with three of those at the same time. And the amount of people that can actually train the people is just very limited because we don't have that many people that have been with us for a long time. So you need to like replicate them, right? And then put the processes and the structure in place to allow us to do that over and over again. So I think that's generally the biggest challenge, is to make sure you've got the right layers and the right people in the right spots to allow for that scale.
So you're saying growing the business is more just the traditional scaling, tiering the business, finding the right people is more challenging than the actual supply chain issue, because it's still a massive space as it is.
So the challenge for us, right, like we don't get involved as much on the inbound part of the, so like if you're our customer, like you will typically work with somebody else to get the inventory over to us. So it has a big impact on our customers, but there's nothing really we can do.
I guess my question on this one was supply chain issues plus iOS issues causing a shrinkage in online sales. And is that more of a challenge than just scaling a business?
So that in itself is a challenge of like organic natural growth of our customers, right? So if you look at our customer base, you know, like let's just say they've shipped, I don't know, whatever, 20 million orders in last year, right? That same amount of customers are probably going to ship the same or less amount of orders in 22 because they've had all these challenges.
So all those years, you basically had natural growth of each client and you just got to make sure you retained
the value of each customer.
Now you have to keep chasing more clients.
So now we have to bring in new business. Yeah, so now we have to bring in a lot more new business. Like if we want to hit the same percentage growth rate, like we have to bring in a lot more new business to offset the fact that our clients is not growing as fast. Because like in 2020, right, without doing literally anything, like even if we didn't onboard any clients, we would just double our business, right? In 22, you know, we need to onboard, like this year, we're probably onboarding $100 million of new business. And that's all, you know, like new business that comes on. But then obviously the existing business possibly shrinks a little bit because of kind of the challenges.
So here's a question that I guess it's an evolutionary part for a company like yours, or maybe not. So at first you started with the low-hanging fruits, small mom and pops that nobody wanted to deal with. Now with competition, everything. Are you trying to double down more on the big size companies more than the little ones?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think that's kind of the biggest like answer or question we're trying to answer internally right now. The benefit of working in the mid-markets, small, you know, businesses is that it's very complex and not a lot of people can actually do it. The downside is there's only so many businesses in that spectrum. And a lot of them, you know, it's not very stable, right? So in the SMB category overall, like you bring them in and then some of them go out of business. You know, some of them are just, you know, it's a little bit harder to manage that piece of business. If you sign up a $50 million client, you know that they're going to most likely be there in 5 years. You sign a longer term contract. So there's a lot more stability, but the margin profile is also very different, right? So I think it's...
So you deal with them different than you deal with the mom and pop?
For sure, yeah. I mean, you have a little bit of a different operations. You put more effort into making sure that they typically build them kind of a more of a dedicated space in the warehouse.
But also, then you have EDI and pallets and shit
like that. Yeah, it gets a lot more. Yeah, more omni-channel, right? They'll do B2B, they'll do B2C, they'll need more buildings. They'll have, you know, a lot more kind of handholding. So, like, I think we've operationally, it's not really an issue, but it's just naturally, if you go to upmarket, your margin shrink because you know you're pricing that more aggressively, right?
And you have to. And now you're saying there's a lot of competition in your space.
And yeah, I mean, there's been a lot of competition because a lot of venture money have flown into the space. And you know, we've been bootstrapped, like we've always put all the money. We've always wanted to be profitable. So like a lot of our competitors that raised hundreds of millions of dollars, they throw money at acquiring customers and they'll pay to lose money, right? To serve them.
Which is challenging for you.
Which is challenging. If you're trying to make money and like you're competing against somebody that is okay to lose money, then like it's like, how do you win the deal? Like you can be better, but somebody's offering 20% cheaper service, like you just can't compete with it, right? So now it's changing. Like even the ones that have raised a lot of money, their valuations are coming down. Nobody wants to give them more money, right? They are right-sizing their pricing because they realize they have to make money. So it actually,
they actually have to operate
easier.
A business.
Good times, good times.
It's like, hey, like there's actually businesses to make money at some point, you know? And look, there's businesses that like in software, there's definitely a world where, you know, you have to spend money to acquire a customer. Yeah. If you have enough of a lifetime value calculated, like you can lose money to acquire that customer. And at some point you make money. But in logistics, it's like, in fulfillment, it's if your gross margin is negative, you know, meaning like I ship 100 packages for you and I lose money on every single package I ship. There's no way that's ever going to scale, right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
And a lot of these companies, that's what they're doing, right? Like they're just burning through cash and like they think that with scale, they're going to figure it out and actually their cost is going to come down. But
it's a cyclical thing I've seen in many categories where you start with don't show me profit, you better not. until the whole market turned into EBITDA driven. And no investor wants to touch you unless you're profitable. And from one day to another, it switches.
Yeah.
And the problem I've seen with companies, and I had that when I had buyers coming to buy big private equities, and they said, it's kind of like a Kool-Aid that you give a company that was already operating under debt. They're used to operate under debt. Now you tell them, now you start need, you got to make profit now. They don't know how to ever turn profit.
Well, it's a cultural thing.
Yeah, right? It's like a cultural thing.
Because if you think about like, and this is kind of the funny thing, right? That's like the market today, obviously, is everybody wants to see profit. Forever, you know, forever, the last couple of years has been like, oh, just want to see growth. Like, we don't really care if you're making money. You actually shouldn't make money. You should burn as much as possible. There's a funny thing that one of the investors that I've spoken with maybe 5 years ago, I've asked this lady that works for private equity. I say, hey, what do you think is our biggest risk? We weren't growing nicely at this time. We're pretty early, like maybe 10 million in revenue, but we're making money. You know, we had like a million in EBITDA at that time, right? And I asked her like, hey, what are we missing? Like, what's our risk? And she said, your biggest risk is to be profitable, because then people are going to value on EBITDA multiple and not on revenue multiple. You know, and I was like, how screwed up is that? Like,
that's you, so you know, messed up.
I mean, this is where I think it's interesting. I think you should tell the story when we're talking about that. You were, and she wasn't wrong, actually, probably, because when you're in January, you're all getting an offer.
Yeah.
And then that offer changed by the same buyer.
Yeah.
I don't know if you can.
Yeah, I can't. I mean, I can't say the names, but yeah, that is right. Like this was in 2020, right?
So but I've never really operated in a business where you're not trying to be profitable. So I've never really experienced this. But so explain to me why somebody who's VC, private equity, looking at a company that's not profitable, why do they value it at a multiple on revenue?
Well, because there's
no, I know there's no multiple on EBITDA. You can even
you value by the space. If you don't have the measurement of profits, it happened with Jeff Bezos. Jeff Bezos was convincing his people for 20 years that he should not be turning profit. He want to take over he want to own the fulfillment, so no one would be able to beat him. And they were furious that he was the most hated person in a boardroom every time he would come in, but he was standing his ground until he turned profit. He took him 20 years. Now, that kind of like changed a lot of perspective for companies.
But that's also the only metric that you can even.
No, it is not. But for companies it's different when you're not profitable on the SaaS, because mm-hmm. you have 95% retention or whatever year over year.
Well, gross margin is like.
But then when you have, like when you sell a particular product, when you sell a particular goods and you're actually pushing money out, the engine has to make sense. And it's like, don't worry about the engine. It will make sense once I open another 17 locations and the logistic is going to be cheaper and so on. So it's very hard. It worked for some and it modified the whole industry mindset for investors to say, don't show me your profit because that's going to be your judgment.
Because what else? Because I mean, if you think about it, right? If you're an investor, somebody's showing you a business and they're like, hey, this, you know, we're 10 million in revenue, losing money, like whether they're losing a million or 25 million, how do you use any of that to value the business?
Can't.
You have to look at the revenue.
You have to look at revenue.
And you have to look at growth. And you have to look at, you know, the industry comparables, right? But like in our world, you know, it's in software where you're losing, where your gross margin is 90% or 50% or 70, whatever, but you're losing money overall because you're investing in acquisition. Yeah. It's like you can make that argument somewhat that in the future, when you have enough of a customer base, you're going to turn profit, right?
I mean, that's what Uber did. That's
a lot of, the crazy thing, there's a lot of examples where this worked,
but then
you don't hear about the 90% of the examples where that doesn't
work. Well, you do sometimes. Right? I mean, that was
majority
Bolt.
Don't work.
You know Bolt?
Yeah, yeah.
So that didn't work for them. I think it's Bolt.
I don't know Bolt.
Bolt is a payment processing software, basically. And they basically grew with ridiculous valuations. I don't think they were ever.
No, you're talking about Fast.
Fast. The one click. Oh, Fast. Sorry, not click. Yes. Bolt was a competitor, excuse me.
Yes.
So Fast did this.
Yes. And then, $1 billion valuation.
Yeah, it was like $1 billion valuations. They raised $300 million at $1 billion valuation, went bankrupt like a month after they raised that round. Yeah. Something like that. But that was the issue, right? So they were still software.
Mm-hmm.
And I think their revenues were like, I'm going to get this number wrong, but it was in like the hundreds of thousands per year.
Yeah.
That
there was nothing
it.
Special. Like, the one click, okay.
Their burn rate was 10x their revenues.
Yeah, but that's
like,
well, but that's the and like that's, you know, because there's been so much money thrown into venture, like that's just, you know, forcing these investors to invest, which is artificially driving these valuations up, which is forcing the entrepreneurs to spend money which they don't necessarily need, right? So it's accelerating the cycle, and there's definitely examples where it's worked great, right? So, you know, that like Amazon was kind of the pioneer in that, and it's worked well. But like, I think there's so many other businesses where. Or verticals that you just can't do it, right?
Yeah.
Or, you know, like some of our competitors, exactly in a gross negative margin environment, they're claiming like, oh, once we get big enough and we'll, you know, have all these customers, that's when we start making money. But
I think Chewy is a great example. If you look at Chewy, which is a dog online pet store, Chewy was acquired for $3.5 billion by Ryan Cohen. And he sold this to, I forget the name of the private equity that owns, I think, Petco. Or the other,
and then they took it public.
It got to a point that there were $30 billion valuation, and then they fall off a cliff. But what once it turned EBITDA driven, because there are no, it's still not profitable. Everything they've ever made, they're losing money. The actual engine is not profitable when you ship 70 pounds of dog food.
You have cogs. You have like
you have everything. Yes. Yeah. So I mean, but it's like a musical chair thing that a lot of investors are playing, where they said, okay, there'll be 16 rounds or so. I'm going to just jump from this round to another round. Yeah. Can I go and I still
bid this? But you know what? I'm going to get out before anybody has to deal with this.
Exactly.
Issue.
Exactly.
It's a musical chair. Definition of a Ponzi scheme, by the way.
It's like, technically, it is.
Not a lot of underlying value, which, I mean, it's you know, it's funny, but like that's what a lot of venture has been like the last couple of years, right? It's like, hey, I'm investing in A. I'm just hoping somebody's going to invest at a higher valuation in C. And I think that's where we're going to be up for a pretty interesting realization right now in the next couple of months, where all these people need money, but nobody's going to give them the same valuation they've given them 6 months ago.
Nobody.
So we're going to see a lot of, I mean, you know, there's just really funny memes now coming like around on, you know, around venture, which is just like, you know, people begging for money, and VCs are just basically like, yeah, like we're not giving you the money at the valuation.
And you show them all the great business that this time it's actually working.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, it's a tough time.
What are some of the biggest fuck ups that you've made as you scaled?
Oh.
Let's go through some of the things so that people don't have to.
There's so many.
Them.
There's...
Tell them about the one where you're on some on Black Friday. Tell them the Black Friday scenario.
Yeah, so I mean, you know, this is logistics, so there's a lot of fuck ups all the time. Like you're working with people, and they always make mistakes. It's a really interesting industry. But the what happened on Black Friday? This was maybe 2017. And we just moved into a new warehouse in Deerfield, just like 30,000 square feet. And then we're operating. And Black Friday is obviously the biggest day of the year for us, right? Like the sales go through the roof. And we hired a ton of people and like we just get ready. And then I was actually in North Carolina somewhere. And I just get a call the day before Thanksgiving, which, you know, obviously that's the day before Black Friday. And they're like, hey, like we've got, you know, we've had a little bit of an issue with power and we lost power. And, you know, we think it's going to be up like in 2 hours. 2 hours that I could call and like, oh, the electrician came and the transformer burned out. And there's no way we can replace the transformer until the morning. Until Monday morning, which was, this was Wednesday before Thanksgiving, right? And so like the like, none of the stores are open until Monday. Yeah. So you're going to be not operating for 5 days. Now in any other business, that probably would have been okay. For us though, like we literally, if we weren't operating for those 5 days, like we would be out of business. There's no question. Because you get so behind that like you just can't hire enough people to get out of it. So I flew back, you know, we looked at the situation. We're like, man, like we're screwed. Like, what are we going to do? We ended up doing is we ended up like basically cutting through a hole in the warehouse to our neighbor's place. And we tapped into their, like panel, like electrical panel, and basically ran extension cords. I sent my like 20 people that I had like all to different like Walmarts and Home Depots. I'm like, buy all the extension cords they have. So we bought, I'm not joking, like 10,000 feet of extension cords, brought it all back, ran it from that one freaking panel in the other warehouse and just connected every single peripheral in the warehouse, like pack stations, scanners, Wi-Fi, internet, everything, right? Because the thing just burned down and we couldn't get any replacement. So we're like, well, without power, we can't operate. So we, you know, it took us, I don't know, a whole day to kind of do that. And like it looked like Honduras in there, like you had just wires everywhere, right? Like it was just like in the streets of just, you know, I mean, it was crazy, but it was great to kind of see the team come together and like really solve this problem that seemed unsolvable at the time and really saved the business, right? Like it was, you know, we had a 1 day delay, but made in and you know, and it was,
nobody
it was
could
great
tell.
To rally together. No nobody tell, could yeah. tell. But it could have been pretty detrimental, you know?
I think that, you know, like doing stuff like that is what defines like great entrepreneurship, right? Because a lot of people, when they hit a wall like that, they don't think of, I mean, even when you were closing customers at CES, like there's like attitudes that make a good entrepreneur, because you look at where you came from, where you're at now, and everyone can be like, oh, you know, you rode the wave of e-com. And dude, there's a lot of ways you could fuck this up along the way.
Oh, yeah.
A thousand different ways.
Yeah. You know, it's another funny one. Like this is maybe not as fun. Well, it's pretty funny, but it's not as like that was a fuck up. Like we, so obviously the biggest issue in our business is like you miss you know, you ship somebody else's inventory to the wrong customer, oh, right? Wow. And so like you have 100 customers in your building, they all carry totally different products, right? And so we would have, you know, we would have products that would be like pet toys, we would have products that are like t-shirts, and we would have like baby, you know, clothing or whatever. And we would have a customer, it's called Cat Lady Box. It's actually a local company, great business, right? They sell products to like cat ladies.
Yeah.
And somehow, and actually like, I almost still think it was like intentional, because this lady, right? Like we ship her, she ordered a Cat Lady Box with all these products. And we accidentally ship her a t-shirt from like an influencer, which was like this like young kid that like is like a YouTube influencer, and it said Pussy Slayer on it.
Oh my God.
And we're just like, holy shit. And we saw the picture, you know, she took it so well. She was like, God. You know, like, I love my cats. Like, this is not funny. And it just like, and it was literally like Pussy Slayer on this shirt, right? And this, I just imagined this huge lady somewhere in like middle of Idaho, you know, opening this, excited for this Cat Lady Box. She opens this and says Pussy Slayer on it.
That's crazy.
And like, it was the most funny, hilarious mistake we made. And they were very like brave about like taking that. But we did have, you know, scenarios where we accidentally shipped like a strap on to, you know, a kid that ordered like something else. Like, unfortunately, and we've obviously processes around it to now not happen again. But you have some of these like most random things that happen that are just,
you know, about funny. those mistakes or things. When we had our customer service, we had stories, and we thought, oh, we got some stories with customer service. So we brought our CTO that had a dating site, and when we thought we have some stories, he told us his stories on his dating site.
Oh, I'm sure he has ridiculous stories on his dating
site. I was like, listen, man, this website of yours, what's up with that? I'm taking this girl on a date and I'm buying her dinner. I'm dropping her off, but she doesn't let me go to her house, or she doesn't want to come to my house. You need to call her and tell her to come to my house.
Are you serious?
Yes.
What?
Like, what?
It's a good customer service. Because it's like, yes. Man, this guy probably wants you to show up.
Yes.
Yeah, it's funny.
Yeah, it's fine. We had one time where this lady sent us an email, and she said, that was early on, and when we didn't know what to do, I had always a solution. So she said, listen, I've been subscribed for 12 months, getting your boxes. Now, I never really use them. I keep them. My house, it was burnt. So what are you going to do? Give me the money back for all my boxes. So it was all fresh for us. And I said, you know, usually you should tell her, look, I'm sorry, but call your insurance. But call Ipsy. Tell them the same story. See what they're going to say. That was early on. So then Ipsy came up with their response and then said, it's exactly what we said. Just call your insurance. And we would pass it on every time when we had this. We also had the girl that was saying, listen, you guys withdrew my money, but I didn't have enough money in the bank. So now I ended up with this guy. I got knocked out. Now I'm pregnant. So you guys have to take care of the baby now. Yeah, we had all kind of crazy stuff.
How crazy did not having stories. Money in the bank have to do?
It's they're trying. They try.
Oh, but you know what? Like I get messages. You'd be surprised. I would say probably a couple a week now in check.
Yeah.
You know, because like people have seen obviously the news articles and everything, and like they'll just email me random on Instagram and be like, hey, like, you know, I have a baby and like I'm a gambler and like I really need to borrow $50,000 to like build a new house. And I'm like, okay, cool. Like, great. Like, would love to help you, but I don't think this is the way to like do it. And you know, it's not like, anyway.
This is not customer service. This is just people hitting you up for money.
Yeah, no. But like, random people, right?
Like, that happens to me too, but it's just weird. It's very strange. But I mean, that's probably a whole bunch of scammers too, right?
Oh, like, for sure. Yeah.
No, I'm sure it's true.
Yeah, I need to connect you with this FX trader guy. Like, he's been promising me that he can make me billions of dollars. Yes.
I have great options for you.
Binary
options trading opportunities.
They're based out of Kenya, amazing. Though. So I don't know if that's going to work for you.
I'm sure it's going to work.
I have a question. It's interesting because you both just mentioned like these like customer success, customer service stories. How involved should a CEO be in customer service?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think it's very different in a B2C versus B2B environment. Think in a B2C environment where you've got thousands of customers, like you have to, you know, you can't, like, I mean, I think you might be able to take calls, but it's very hard to stay unbiased.
You have how many? You have 2,500 employees.
2,500 employees, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, you can be obviously removed, but some people still try and
I think what's important,
the loudest complaints.
I think what's, well, in a B2C world, right, like not our business, but like when you have tens of or hundreds of thousands of customers, like I don't think there's a way, I mean, you can take a call for fun like every once in a while, but I think in order for you to truly make a difference, like you need to just measure the right metrics and then ultimately help improve the business according to like what people are complaining about. In our business, we try to do the same thing, but our business, there's a lot more weight on the bigger customers. So like I'll, you know, have a personal relationship with a lot of the bigger clients that I'll know personally. And then, you know, I'll try to spend time with them to try to really understand, not necessarily like individual problems, but more what are macro things that are where we can be better, we can help them better, we can create a better solution, right? Like what are the things that they're seeing in the industry, or what are the things that are bothering them that we may be able to come up with a solution for, right? So I wouldn't necessarily call it a customer service where like I'm like, hey, this package like didn't ship. Like I don't really do that. Although I used to a lot to kind of try to understand what, you know, how the product is actually performing. But now it's more, what are the patterns? And then how do we make a better product based on the feedback? But I do think...
How do you do that though? How do you keep a finger on the pulse?
Yeah, so it's like the right data, right? So, you know, categorizing tickets and complaints and like really understanding like what are the different segments that people... like the way that I'll give you a specific example, right? So when people complain, we mark a ticket. Like we kind of measure the mood of that ticket, right? Like, is it a question? Is it a, you know, is it a bug? Is it like, hey, this customer is really pissed because we screwed something up? Like, if that's the case, we kind of classify it that way. And then we choose additional category, like what happened? Is it something we did, or is it something misunderstanding, whatever? And then I'll have a reporting to understand, okay, like 10% of our tickets are all, you know, people that are mad. And then this is the breakdown of like exactly what they're mad about. And then I'll typically productize it to say, how do we make these better, right? If it's the wrong product shipped to the wrong person, you know, operations is going to own it. It's typically going to be tied to a silver metric around accuracy, and I'm going to hold them accountable to improve that metric. If it's,
you have it part of your meetings, like, I don't know, stand-up meetings or something like that?
Yeah, so we'll do, so I have like executive one-on-ones with everybody once a week, and then we'll have like one executive meeting with everybody. These are more typically like, we'll do this not, you know, we'll do this once a quarter where we do our OKR meeting. So we'll figure out like, what are the things that we can improve our customer experience, and how do we, you know, how do we just make people happier overall? And that is driving some of these initiatives. You know, it could be like, we need to hire more people to have a quicker response time, right? We need to really focus on accuracy so that we don't have these pussy slayer shirts shipping to people, right?
And I like, love cats.
It could be any of this, any of these things. And there's always, it's a little bit of a guacamole because like there's a million things that are always happening. So you got to prioritize, and it's frustrating because you want to fix them all, but it's just not possible, right? Like you got to just pick the ones that you really want to focus on, get the team behind it, put an owner and then just run with it.
And how do you stack rank like the highest leverable, like highest opportunities or highest leverageable opportunities when you look at all these different problems?
We try to quantify it based on impact. So like typically it's going to be dollar amount of like the people that have issues with it. Like what is the impact if they were to leave Shipmunk, right? So if I have one small customer like complain about something that nobody else has ever complained about, it's obviously going to be ranked a lot different than if I have three of my biggest customers complaining about one of the specific things. So we try to always put a value, quantifiable value towards how many dollars are at stake to figure out what we're prioritizing.
What was when Scott asked you about a mistake, right? Now let's talk a little bit about more like a strategic big time mistake or something, or a missed opportunity that you have that you said, I should have doubled down on something. If there was anything like that that you should have said, well.
Yeah, it's, you know, I think about this a lot because I always, I mean, my mindset in general tries to be, I don't want to regret things because like I feel like we are where we are because of the decisions we made, and like could have been in a better place, like maybe, but I am also pretty happy where we are. So I feel like any
but
decision.
Still, as a learning.
That was like part. Wrong, I think it would have obviously pushed us, right? But I think it's more about hiring the right people.
I know a lot of entrepreneurs listen to this show, and NetSuite has been a huge supporter for entrepreneurs, for business owners, because there's one thing that we all know. Business is about making money, and it's about your bottom line. And the less you spend on the nuts and bolts of running your business, the more profits you keep. But these days, everything is costing more. Supplies, people, shipping. It squeezes your margins, and I've been there, juggling multiple systems for finance, inventory, you name it, each with its own costs and its own set of headaches. That's why I made the switch to NetSuite by Oracle. It's changed our company. Think about it. NetSuite is one of the top financial systems out there. It puts your whole business on one platform, accounting, finance, the works. One data source for everyone. There's no more mismatched info. And because it's in the cloud, it slashes your IT costs. No more servers, no more updates. Just access NetSuite from anywhere. With one integrated suite, your overhead drops big time. And here's the real win. Efficiency. Everything's connected in NetSuite. Costs are ridiculous lately. Find a proven way to reduce your expenses and get better performance out of your team. It's a no-brainer, and that's what NetSuite offers. Over 37,000 companies have figured this out already. You have to join them. Right now, through to April 15th, NetSuite's got an incredible, flexible financing plan. Check it out and see the savings yourself at netsuite.com/ScottClary. That's netsuite.com/ScottClary. Hiring as a small business owner is a major pain. That's why LinkedIn is supporting today's episode. You need people with the right skills and experience, but finding them can take forever. It is incredibly frustrating to keep seeing candidates who just aren't a good fit, and that's why LinkedIn Jobs has been a game changer. Let me tell you a little story. We needed to hire a graphic designer, somebody with specific tech and software knowledge and the ability to truly understand our brand. And I started with all the usual job boards, and it's the same old story. Tons of irrelevant applications. No one's really matching my needs. I tried LinkedIn Jobs, and the quality of candidates was just on another level. People with impressive portfolios, relevant expertise. I finally felt like I was interviewing the right people. That's truly the power of LinkedIn's massive professional network. You're tapping into this huge pool of talent you simply wouldn't find on other sites. It's about finding those niche candidates you actually need. And with the right people in front of you, hiring becomes a breeze. Did you know that 86% of small businesses find a qualified candidate on LinkedIn Jobs within 24 hours? That is how well their system works. Honestly, do yourself a favor and try LinkedIn Jobs next time you're hiring. You can post your job for free at linkedin.com/excellence. That's linkedin.com/excellence. Terms and conditions apply, but it's definitely worth trying out. I don't know about you, but the idea of being harassed, scammed, or even worse, all because somebody found my personal information online, that's terrifying. Our political opinions, our addresses, even stuff about our families, it's out there for anyone to grab. And did you know that data brokers are allowed to sell information on over 98% of Americans? It's scary stuff. That's why I've partnered with Delete Me. I personally use Delete Me. They're a big friend of the podcast because I put myself out there online. So safety is a huge concern. It's really scary how easy it is to find someone's details and information, but Delete Me creates a layer of protection that we all need. You tell Delete Me what you want gone, and they make it disappear from those sketchy data broker sites. And Delete Me doesn't stop. They constantly monitor the web to keep your information off those lists. It's like having a privacy watchdog that never sleeps. You need to take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me. They're giving a special discount for all Success Story podcast listeners. Get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/success and use promo code success at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/success and enter code success at checkout. joindeleteme.com/success. Hey everyone, I just want to take a second and thank the sponsor of today's episode, Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond Bourbon. Now, I don't have a lot of liquor sponsors on this show. Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond is actually one of my favorites. I've drank it for a few years now, and this is why we actually decided to work together. Heaven Hill Distillery, family-owned since 1935, is a great entrepreneur story too. So there's five brothers. They filled their first whiskey barrels back in 1935, and their legacy still lives on today. Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond is aged over 7 years. That's three more than required by the Bottled and Bond Act of 1897. This means the best quality, the best purity, and the best consistency. This is not just average bourbon. It's the winner of the double gold medals at multiple 2023 World Spirits competitions, and they've won the very prestigious Triple Still Award. It's a very big deal in the liquor and bourbon world. Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond boasts an exceptionally smooth oak flavor, while its aroma offers a sweet blend of caramel and smooth vanilla. If you love bourbon, you need to try Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond. Available nationally, look for a bottle at your local store. Heaven Hill reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely. Think back to your last few days in the office. Did any of them leave you feeling really accomplished? Not the kind of day where you're running around like crazy, but where you've made real progress on something that matters. Because being busy doesn't always mean being productive, and I bet you we've all been there, and maybe it's time to rethink what it means to get things done. Today's episode is sponsored by Belay, and what they help you do is, instead of getting sucked into emails and to-do lists, they help you delegate tasks and focus on big goals. They can connect you with top-notch US-based talent who are ready to take on those time-consuming tasks that bog you down. Let's be real, there are way more important things you could be doing than bookkeeping or wrangling a packed inbox. They have virtual assistants to handle all of those pesky administrative tasks, or accounting professional to take care of all your financials. But here's the best part. You don't have to waste weeks searching for the right person. Belay's personalized matching service works quickly, sometimes matching you with the right talent to take stuff off your plate in under a week. Are you ready to try a different way of working? Check out Belay's list of the top 25 things you can delegate to a virtual assistant. It might just change your business and your life. Text SUCCESS, that's SUCCESS, to 55123 to get the list and to start transforming your to-do list with Belay.
All sooner, yeah. Which is kind of the common thing of, I think everybody says that, but yeah. It's, you know, like we hired our first CFO when we were, I think, $70 million of revenue, right? Which is, and I was doing a lot of the QuickBooks before that. And so getting the visibility, getting the quality of data, and getting like really the understanding of the business from a financial perspective sooner definitely would have been pretty impactful. You know, I think maybe like COO has been a role that I've been just trying to hire forever, and it's taking me 4 people to hire the right person. Now I have finally the right person, and that's for me.
So if they listen, all the other ones, they know they were not the right ones.
I think they already know anyway. But that's been the hardest role for me to hire for, and it's taken 3 years. And you know, I don't know what I would have done differently, but I wish I would have hired that person.
It's a matter of luck, right?
And it's a matter of, well, it's also the size of the company, because like I could have never attracted the guy that I have today 2 years before that, right? Gotcha. Like you would have never been interested. And I think that's always a timing thing, you know? So strategically, I think like, honestly, like I think we're like, I'm pretty happy with where we are. So I don't think there would have been like major dramatic changes that I would have done.
But you, like you, okay. So now, like if you look at where your revenue numbers are at now, and I don't know if it's public or not. Is it, are revenues more or less public? So you said
like $350
million. Okay, so if you look at $350 million, that's significant. I mean, if you're talking about CFO at 70, COO, figuring that out right now, it's taken you a while to bring on the right people. But a point you made before was very interesting, how you have this like incredible lifestyle while you're still running this business, even though you're still doing, in theory, all these tasks, right? Yeah. So how did you build this business so that you can still maintain this lifestyle?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think, I mean, I love to enjoy life. So like everything I do is always, I just want to have a great time. And so I try to design my life so that it's not in a way of like, I wouldn't see myself. And I did this for the first 3 years, right? Like I didn't do anything. Like I just worked my ass off the first 3 years. What I realized quick enough is that the more I let go, the more I can enjoy life, the more I can travel, the more I can do different things. I've never been able to, not until recently, like I've been able to completely disconnect where I would go on a trip and I wouldn't work. But what I realized is that like a lot of the, and this is the big, I think this is the most difficult job for any founder to kind of transition from that founder to CEO. And we used to talk about this all the time with Joe, where like
there's, can you explain that point too? Like what does that mean, founder to CEO?
So like a founder wants to be in every decision, right? They want to control everything. They want to like, they're very associated. Like it's the business in them is one thing. Where a CEO tries to disassociate themselves with the business, has a little bit more of an objective view, delegates more, and really empowers people to make decisions. And a founder is not scalable, right? Like you can't scale that mindset over a certain size of a company, depending on the industry, where a CEO, like they understand the value that they can't fix everything, right? And they have to empower the people to fix their own things and hold them accountable to fixing them. And that's been really difficult for me. I mean, it's taken me really 2 years in a lot of departments to kind of let go and empower these people to make these decisions, understanding sometimes they're going to make the wrong choice, right? But sometimes that's okay. If I feel like it's too big of a mistake, then I'll get more involved, dive in, like try to ultimately make sure that it's not a detrimental decision to the company. But by doing that, and I've done it in most departments, you know, kind of it's like a progression. You have a best person for HR, you have to step away in HR, right? Like you have an amazing sales guy, you can step away from sales. Operations for me has been like one of the latest ones that I, you know, been finally able to step away. So that's been taking a majority of my time. But I've been always able to work or do enough to, like when I was remote or traveling, like I've been able, I still been, you know, I was working. And while I was having an amazing time, and it would recharge me to come back and like get to work and just, you know, put a lot of hours kind of back into, you know, really back into the
and you grind. Feel like when you take that time off, it allows you to operate at a higher capacity than
it allows me to disconnect from the day to day and gives me a different perspective. Because if you're in the office every day, right, for whatever, a year straight, like you get so inundated by everybody's asking you questions, you're always like in the weeds, you're trying to solve problems that are just like fires, right? It's just like firefighting. Everything has a fire, you're trying to just kill these fires. But if you get away and you don't have these meetings, right? And like you have to, like you actually have really a time to think about it, you get to get a different perspective on the business.
Yeah, I found that on a day to day, if I would step outside of my office and do stuff, some restaurant, I would be doing all the stuff that I don't do that are higher level than turning off fires. Because people would walk into your office, it's an open
all the
door
time. Everyone wants your validation,
because your mindset is important and urgent, and every time, like, you know, it takes a second. Let me do it. It might not be even urgent or important, and you get yourself caught up with little stuff. So unless you're in a meeting or something like that, people would come in. So I found it absolutely true that you get out, even don't have to take a trip, doing snowboarding or something, but you just walk out of the office. You do it in a restaurant. You spend a couple hours, all the emails you needed to do, all the new opportunities for tomorrow there. And then you go back and you make sure. You know what else helped me a lot to kind of like shy away from this? That little interruptions of the day? Simple. Just write a list of what you got to do. Write a list. And it took me a while to actually say, okay, I'm not as productive. I'm getting to the same point. Just write a list. I'm busy now. Let me finish. This is it that important right now? Do I have to do it today? Okay, no. Okay. Once I tackle all those, I'm free to do everything else.
Yeah.
It was helpful.
I mean, I think structure and overall, like I'm a pretty organized person, right? Like try to, you know, I'm big in working in, and like I use Asana for everyday life. I use Slack, obviously, to communicate with the company, but like everything I do, my day, when I plan it, you know, I have tasks that are like urgent that I need to do that are kind of more tactical, but I also literally create projects that are more strategic, that are more brainstorming, where I like pull in people. And I love to balance both, right? So like I really love getting into product meetings and talking about like, hey, this is our problem. I bring in stakeholders from different parts of the company. We brainstorm, we come up with a solution. And then from that, right, I'll go into a meeting, like a strategic meeting. And we say, where do we want to be in 5 years as a company from a margin, growth, you know, revenue, customer profile. And like balancing those two is super important. Sometimes like because you're into day to day and like, especially if you're killing fires all the time, like it almost seems like the world is ending, mm-hmm. right? Because like everything you're doing is problem solving. And even though you love problem solving, which I do, it just seems, it just makes your brain so focused on these, you know, little issues that it's very difficult to kind of zoom out.
Yeah.
Where if you leave, people that have these little issues, they're not going to go to you. They know you're gone, right? And so like you have to finally kind of like look from above and look at
did
that.
Did you get to a point that they already know not to bug you with little things and there are other people and unless they come to you?
Yeah.
Because that's where the health of the company starts falling into place where, I mean, you said you found a CEO and we spoke about this before. Eric, you know Eric?
Yeah.
It was instrumental, right? I got lucky. I got him early on when I was at 50 million, but he was pretty much taking off a lot of that noise. And it was also helpful because sometimes you need someone to tell you, I don't think you should be messing with this. There are bigger things to do. Let Julie take care of it.
Did Eric say that to you?
Oh, yeah, all the time. Because the thing is with Eric, he was working in Chewy with Ryan Cohen. He was seeing the transformation and he said, look, we've seen this. We've seen the good, bad, and the ugly where founders are founders. There's that CEO disease, the founder CEO disease, which is kind of like can't let go. You have your favorites, all that. And it's good to hear it, right? You hear it one time, it's like,
I think that's the most difficult thing. And it just really depends on the personality of the CEO. But it's like, it becomes, you know, there's this thing that like, it's really lonely at the top, right? And I think that's so true because most people are never going to give you honest feedback as a CEO. Mm-hmm. And I actually still to this day haven't really found a good way to get honest feedback because I try to ask for it all the time. But like, if I work for you, like, it's difficult for me to tell you like, hey, you suck at this, you shouldn't do this. Like, unless we have a really strong relationship and we work together for a long time. So I have few people in the company that will try to tell me, because it's actually the opposite. Everybody's trying to kiss your ass all the time, right? They're like, they never want to tell you the bad news. They want to make themselves look in the best light. You know, it's difficult to really see yourself for who you are, which I think is one of the most difficult things as a CEO is to actually get honest feedback about yourself and figure out how you can be better.
What about your partners, your investors?
They're high level. Yeah, they don't know how I operate, right? Like they, you know, I see them at board meetings and they have pretty good input strategically, but like they wouldn't be the ones telling me like, hey, this is not the stuff you should be involved with, or this is not how you should have communicated this. This is not, you know, you should have yelled at this guy, like whatever that is, right? Like it's, so I think I try to be more reflective to really become, and I have a CEO coach who kind of helps me with this, but you know, it's like, it would be super helpful to have somebody on the team that's like, and I use my head of HR, which actually used to be head of HR for Chewy too for a long time, to kind of coach me on these situations where it's like, hey, like, don't get upset. Like, think about it. Take a step back. And then let's have that conversation next week. And that's important because you're always passionate as a founder, right? And so, like, you have this instinct of solving problems and everything is a nail, you know, when you have.
But do you feel sometimes it's time to say no? Because, I mean, you said, look, I know what to strip down. Okay, now I don't need to do HR, do someone good. I don't have to do customer service. But operation, I still couldn't find another me or better to go and take over. So I'm going to stay there. Right? And then you find yourself going to the granular details and they tell you, I don't deal with the minutiae. If someone comes to tell you that, like, well, if I don't deal with this type of minutiae, that minutiae is actually important. Yeah. So if you kind of like make those, do you still find yourself in those positions?
Yeah, for sure. Because I think what, and this is, I think, where a lot of leaders fail, where, you know, I've seen this in our business, where some leaders are just going to want to be high level. Like I'm the head of sales. Like I don't need to understand how our like sales guys take a call and like, what's our value prop or whatever, right? Like
I have massive issue with that.
Yeah. No. It's a biggest issue. And I've hired the wrong people sometimes, right? Because they'll think like, oh, they're this entitled like VP person or like whatever. And it's below them to like get down in the weeds and do this stuff, right? And there's so many people like that. And I have a huge issue because in my mind, like if you are overseeing a certain department, you should know and be able to replace any single person on your team, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Because if you can't answer a basic ticket as a VP of customer success, then like how can you coach people or like keep them accountable to answering these types of tickets, right? Like it doesn't really make a lot of sense. And so I think that balance between being able to do a deep dive when you need to versus staying high level and delegating to your leaders is extremely important. And you can't do, you know, you can't just be in the weeds all the time because then like you're not really useful, but you have to keep that balance because that's the only way to really like scale a business.
You know, let me say something. When you grow a company, and this is where I want you to tell me how you guys do it. I guess the challenge is once you start tiering the organization from being very flat, it was just you, Johnny, and managing a bunch of people. Now there's just you, then there's C-levels and VPs or SVP. So how many tiers do you have in your organization?
So it depends on the department. Like, you know, mostly, I mean, we have VPs, directors.
Is it from the lowest to the CEO, how many levels?
Yeah, I mean,
four, five, six?
Like, on average, I would say five. Like okay, operations. So five. Operations is like nine, for example.
Okay, but within them, they have more. Okay, so then, do you find yourself being more structured with meetings where some people spend more time in meetings than actually working, or you're able to dodge that and still keep yourself more like back in the
right,
just one
like
or two meetings?
Big company problems now. I guess at 2,500.
It's a, yeah. I mean, I think we're definitely, yes, I think we do. I think we're slowing down in a lot of the decision-making ability that we used to have, like agility. I think any, like innovation is tied to agility. And I think agility is so important in success of any business. The whole reason why companies, big companies get outcompeted by small guys with no money is because they just, you know, they're able to innovate, pivot on the spot. And I, one of the
things I asked a question, by the way, I'm sorry I cut you off, because when you said quarterly review meetings that I have, it's like, that was the once you hear that, it's kind of like a formula. Okay, there's the annual, there's semi, there's quarterly, there's just all those meetings that kind of give me stomachache when I hear. And it's like,
you know, it's funny because like, and I think there's a balance, right? Because like, I hate the whole concept of, oh, we are going to be corporation. Things are going to be slow. We're going to have all these like bullshit meetings that everybody has. But at some point, though, like you realize there's no other way to run a company, because if you get a certain size, you have to be able to have some sort of structure. Otherwise, like the company is just going to fall apart. So like even if you're a CEO that like doesn't want a structure, and I hate having weekly meetings, but if I don't, I'm never going
to
actually... Like,
absolutely. You need to connect everybody. You need bridges. You need to make sure that everybody is on the same page. But the challenge I've seen with meetings is because I've seen both sides. In BoxyCham, we were small amount of corporate people. Then we had lots of, I mean, our fulfillment wasn't done by us, so that cuts off hundreds of employees. And if you took, you know, if you look at customer service, yeah, we had people in customer service, but most of them were outsourced, or hundreds of them. All, but the idea was always like about 150 employees, right, running a $500 million business. And then when we were acquired by Ipsy, similar story, right? But they had about 500 employees. But still, similar story. Almost the same revenue. They're about 20% more. And it was all night and day. And when they said, okay, you're going to manage BoxyCharm, after 2 weeks, I said, okay, I'm not doing that. That's it. I'm not sitting in meetings all day. From every day, all day. And there was just all my team had to be in meetings all day. None of them did the job. So obviously, it's needed once you have more people, right? They had 16 layers from the bottom all the way to the CEO. We had 4 or 5 or something like that.
Yeah.
But the question is, when are you start seeing that you're overly doing that, so you stop yourself from it? How do you know
it's honestly something we're dealing with right now, right? Because how do you know whether you have too many layers or...
Not too many layers, like too many meetings, too many people in the meetings.
Too many layers leads to too many meetings, exactly. Because you have to...
And so like a great example, yeah. Our customer support team, right? Like we kind of merged when we acquired one of these companies that we bought. We merged the support team, so we have about 150 people on our support team, and it's a mix of customer support, account management, fairly complex stuff, right? But you've got 150 people, and originally, you know, we would have like one person that would basically like, or a team of like 4 people, and we would have an account manager, and then maybe they would report to a VP, so like 3 layers, right? And then we kind of did a reorg early in the year. Somehow, I don't even know how this happened, but we like basically created like 6 or 7 layers. And then what we realized, it wasn't necessarily the meetings in this particular case, it was the time it took to make a decision. Because if Joe here didn't know what to do, he went to his VP, right? Like that guy didn't feel empowered, so he went to his like manager. That manager didn't really know what to do, so went to the junior director, and then the senior director. And then by the time this all happened, a week went by, and the customer like was like, where is my answer, right? And like, there's a balance between empowering people and like getting too many approvals. And you need to have structure in place where, you know, you want to balance between empowering people and
so when
like
you have
controls.
A situation like this, okay, when you said, okay, a box is not being shipped, all right? Sometimes the proper way to structure a meeting makes more sense, because it's a similar situation where I saw after we were acquired, where there are so many meetings, so many people, but people didn't get their boxes on time, complaints, months and months goes by. And then the most important part was every day, every week should be a meeting where everyone is synced. Are there any delays? Who's going to be delayed? Why are they going to be delayed? Can we in advance preemptively go and contact them, right? It wasn't passed on to the next business. So ideally is that it's not about, I guess the challenge is like, not about how many meetings is the substance of the meetings. And when I always looked at this as from the morning until say 2 p.m., you got to make sure that those people work the actual work and do tactical stuff. Everything else after, push them to meetings, because you're the most productive before you have your lunchtime.
Yeah.
So you're more creative, more passionate. Meetings is just draining.
Yeah, I mean, I think it depends on the role, right? Like you got individual contributors who should spend most of their time working. I think the higher up you get, the more meetings you're spending time in. But like if you're a VP of support, right? Like most of your day is not going to be actually working. It's going to be managing your team. And so if you're managing your team, you have to be meeting with the individual team members. Maybe you meet with customers, but there's not a lot of like busy work that people do in those roles. And so I think there's a balance between my mindset's always been creating a structure so that you don't have repetitive meetings about things that can be solved separately outside of the meeting, right? In my mind, a meeting is used for, I need people's input, or I need to brainstorm about a problem we have. How do we come up with a solution? And then let's take it away and actually work on this, right? And maybe we meet in a week to brainstorm again. Where I think this breaks down is like, hey, like we need to review the boxes that didn't ship, and then you bring 10 people in every single time. Like that doesn't make sense to me, because it's like, that's the same problem that happens every single week. Like you don't need 10 people for that, right? Like let's have a report. Let's have one person own it and then let them figure out like what they're doing instead of trying to pull in people from like 20 different places, right? So I think there's a difference between like repetitive meetings that I'm not a big fan of, where are trying to like solve a repeatable problem, versus we need to come up with a solution to a problem like this that will then prevent us from having those meetings in the future, if that makes sense.
On a side note, you know, Czech Republic, this is the country that consumes more beer per capita than any other country in the world.
So I'm drinking tequilas.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm being the anomaly of Czech people.
When you have all these layers, I'm curious as to how you came to all these layers. And when I think about why you would add on layers, is because you want to incentivize people to join your organization. You want to show them room for growth or whatever. And then you basically want to help them grow in their career. But then you have like the seven layers that you didn't even.
That's a great point, because I've never thought about it that way, right? Like, I've never thought about, I want to create layers so that people have career growth, right? Like, and this is my like weakness, where I don't really think that way for people, where I'm like, oh, I want to hire people so that
I don't think you should actually. I don't think you should do that.
Yeah, I do think there's an element to it, right?
But you should find other ways for it.
Yeah. And I'm learning, like, especially from my COO, who's worked in a company with 25,000 people, where like you need to do that, otherwise you start having big retention problems. So there's definitely a world where that makes sense. But I've always thought about it more like, okay, like, is this person way too overwhelmed with what they're doing? And if they are, that means most likely they're managing way too many people. Or they don't have good people that are under them. So we need to put a layer in between to really help them, like, bridge it, right? Yeah. So, like, it's never, for me at least, it's never been like, oh, we need, you know, this person's, like, ability to grow. Like, I think with us, because we've grown so quickly, there's always opportunities
for growth. So let me just articulate this. So you're saying, in the way you've seen the growth was, okay, one manager cannot manage more than six people. Now we have already 12. Okay, we need another manager, but someone has to manage. Once you have three managers, someone has to manage them. Now, as natural growth of people, now you're going to go and have another layer, which is a director. Otherwise, you're going to have a manager managing two people, but because you need to have a bunch of layers, and it makes no sense, I guess.
Exactly, right. Yes. And sometimes what we find ourselves in is like, we have one person managing one person, and then they manage a team of three people, right? And I'm like, that doesn't make any sense. Like, why?
But that's a promotion for career progression, exactly. And not... It's a bullshit promotion.
Yeah,
it's
totally. People wanted a title to put on the resume. Well, reasons.
Actually. It's a problem with the millennial generation, right? Like, everybody wants a strategic director, value in the company.
Right? So your junior director managing the same direct reports as a senior director. I mean...
No, to the director, which reports to the senior director.
Yeah,
there's
exactly.
Already extra
there's
layer.
Junior, senior. Yeah, I mean...
Junior, no junior, and then a senior.
This is the thing where, like, I just get so tired of these corporate bullshit.
It is.
Like,
so
like politics, right? Yeah. So, like, politics. I've never heard that word in our company ever until a year
you start
ago,
doing
right?
it.
Where,
yes.
You know, now it's like, man, like, we can't do this because there's this... I'm like, how... You know, like, we're here to run a business. Like, we don't... And I'm not the most... empathetical leader, I would say. Like, I try to get shit done, and sometimes.
Hey guys, I'm about to go on a ski vacation. Please finish it up, all right?
No, but like, my mindset is like, hey, let's get this thing resolved.
Yeah.
And I kind of sometimes like don't really worry about people's feelings as much, which maybe, especially in the US, it's a little
bit of
a problem.
You're going to get canceled on this podcast. No,
but you know what?
You.
If you're aware enough of yourself and how you lead, then you find somebody that is better at managing people.
Yeah,
that's fine.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm well aware of that. That's totally my weakness, right? Like, something can be pretty tough and it's not the best for the organization, for culture and all that stuff, but it gets shit done, right? The opposite of that, which is the things that I also hate, it's like, you know, you suck at your job. And I don't want to tell you that. So I'll pat you on the back and say, hey, you're amazing. But like this thing, like, you know, can you please do it better next time? Right. And that doesn't change anything either. So like, I think there's a balance between being, you know, walking around and patting people on the back
and telling
them how
great
they're doing.
Jen, I think you're doing the right thing, because once you actually give a compliment, people cherish
it. Matters. Yeah.
It
yeah.
matters, right?
Yeah.
It's not a cheap compliment because
well,
you do it all the time.
It's an Eastern European thing, right? Like, we're not used to, even as kids, like, our parents don't praise us for doing normal things, right?
Yeah.
And you get in this like award culture that is typically in the US, where like every kid wants an award, even if they're last.
Yeah.
So it's like everybody wants an award, or they want, you know, to say how great of a job they're doing, even if they suck. And so like the school of thought I come from, and this is more where I grew up, is like, you get a good job or thank you if you really do a great job. If you just do your job, I don't tell you anything. If you suck, I'll tell you suck. And it's not like, again, I've been learning to change that a little bit. So I'm more, you know, even people that kind of do their job, like, I'll tell them they're doing a great job, and it's not the most, it doesn't make me like, doesn't come naturally to me. But it does produce results. It doesn't always create the best environment.
Reinforce the status quo does produce results for you.
I think if you have strong leaders, it does. If you have people that need that, right? Like, it's all about recognizing people's like egos, because like there's people that are very sensitive and they want praise all the time. And then,
but I mean, John, listen, I've been to your headquarters and I can live there. You have these huge screens. When you walk into his headquarters here in Deerfield, where was it?
Fort Lauderdale.
Fort Lauderdale. It's you walk in, I think 250,000 square feet, but he probably took about 20 or 30,000 square feet just for office space, where he made it a loft. And in between, in that section, he has a stage. And there is, you know, those TVs that are all connected? I'm talking something like 18 feet.
Like what you see at a sports bar or something.
Yeah, huge.
Yeah.
No, it's one big screen. Yeah, it's
and cool. Then he has a whole arcade area and cables. And he throw parties over there.
Oh, so you want to
work there. So you're talking about, okay, so
no,
listen.
No, I'm not, if you're not doing a great job.
Yeah. You're a streak,
I'm a super nice guy, right? Like, overall. But I do expect a lot from people, right? Yeah. And I think that's where the balance is. And you know, and that's why, like, I need people, especially my executive team. Like, my executive team knows that I can be tough, but they also know I'm fair, right? Like, I'm not tough because if I tell you to do something and then it doesn't happen, then I can be tough. But I also appreciate when you do something right. And that's why, honestly, like, having that layer of really strong executives under me has been super beneficial to everybody, right? Because sometimes, like, I get emotional and I get, you know, I want to get shit done, and sometimes people's emotions get in the way.
They buffer you a little bit.
They buffer me, yeah. And it's been really good because, you know, like, my type of leadership doesn't work for everybody, and it's sometimes, especially for a broader population, it's not always positive, right? Joe gets like that too. Like, he can get pretty riled up.
I don't believe in cheap popularity. I believe in being who you are, and I'm not trying to go. I'm a pretty awesome person, I think. I'm a fun guy. Ask my ex-wife. I'm sure she's going to say that. But I definitely agree that you don't get things done just because you give flowers to everybody. You have to go and explain to them, look, that was the mistake. You go with substance, explain why.
But you also have to know how to manage people based on their personality.
For sure.
They could be high performers, but you have to know how they
absolutely, yes. Yeah, because this is not zeros and ones, right? You're not managing computer. You are going to have emotions. People are not always going to be the way you want them to speak. It is what it is, and it's fine. As long as they come with substance. I think the point I'm taking from what you're saying is the yes people is something that I couldn't stand. People tell you you're right about everything, and I need your fucking feedback. Yeah. Don't go and tell me I'm right about everything. I want you to tell me where I'm wrong. And what I used to say is, look, if you said I'm right, and I do it and I fail, I'll come back and I say, okay, you're no longer giving me leverage. Just remember that. I'll go to someone else. You're not I want you to tell me, and the ones that I kept with me across, along, throughout the journey, were the ones that would debate me all the time. It was easy for me to pick them.
It's also super important to be able to, like, be self-aware enough where you can take negative feedback, and you're self-aware of if you made a mistake. And I think it goes a long way when you admit to the people, like, let's just say that I think you fucked something up, right? And I'll come and tell you fucked something up, and I'll go around like, hey, like, you know, we need to, this is how we need to be better, whatever. And if I find out that I was wrong, like, my assumption was that you screwed something up, but you actually didn't, it was like something else happened, then I have to own that, and I have to be very direct about, hey, I'm sorry, I fucked up, I thought it was your fault, it really wasn't your fault, like, I apologize, and then move on. I think a lot of people have big enough ego where, like, they just don't want to do that. Then it screws up the culture, because then it's like, oh, this guy's always right. And that's like, I will the first one to admit that I'm wrong. You know, I'll question everything that, like, if I have an opinion, I want everybody else to validate it or have a discussion about, like, okay, what are we doing next? And I think that's where I've learned, like, leadership is so important, because you want to make a firm decision when you are making it as a leader. But I think having everybody else's feedback and, like, thoughts before you make that decision, and make, like, really thinking through it with them, loops them in the process, and then make sure that everybody's bought in, right? Where, like, if you just, you know, if 10 people tell you, like, oh, this is the wrong way, and then you just go for it anyway, like, I think that doesn't create a good culture, because then they feel like it's not one team.
Yeah.
I gotta ask you now a question that probably everyone asked you that before, because I know anyone like us get those questions. When you cashed out, what was your feeling?
Why did you cash out? I guess that's also a good question.
Well, let's start with one question at a time. Why would you want to get a couple? Why would you want to get a couple hundred million dollars? I think it's. But we can go back to it. But when you cash out, when did you actually process that? Shit, my life is different. How long did it take you to process?
So, I mean, it's a great question, right? And it's funny, because when I started, my whole goal of the business was, like, one time, at one point I want to sell, and my goal was to sell it for more than $100 million. And then I did, you know, I did this kind of funny back of the napkin math that like, if I sell it for $100 million, I'll have $5,000 every day for the rest of my life to live my life. Soon, you know, then I eventually realized, oh, this actually now works. You know, you first you pay taxes and then you actually can make money on your money. So yeah. It was very naive, like, you know, I was 21 years old, math, but that just,
you were sitting with us in the EO group and he said, I need $100 million. Then he came back. Actually, I need more than $100 million. Actually, it's going to be enough because it was really funny. It was like, I want this RV to travel over the world. I remember something like that. Yes.
By the way, I just bought.
Oh, congrats.
2 weeks ago.
Nice.
Yeah. But, So I had this dream of like, one day I want to sell the company. I knew I didn't want to do the business forever, like my whole life, right? We ran the process. You know, we didn't really know if we're going to sell the whole business through strategic or private equity. And then the process kind of ultimately ended up landing where it did, meaning selling, you know, half the company through private equity. And it was, the beauty was like, I knew that it gives me options, right? So like at that time, like I'm, you know, I've cashed out enough where I would have not had to work for the rest of my life. But at the same time, I still had a massive upside for the business to do really well. And so it was kind of the best of both worlds. It didn't obviously give me the freedom to kind of like walk away and say, okay, like now I'm going to, you know, travel through Africa in my RV for a year. But it gave me enough financial freedom to be able to know that I will be able to do it in the future and that I don't really have to worry about, you know, buying falafel and
falafel every day as much as you want.
Yeah. Falafel every day.
You're good.
Falafel every day. It's been always my dream. No, but it's so the feeling was honestly very. It was.
When did it hit it? Was it right away when you saw the money? Or was it?
It wasn't relief. It was. Our process was very stressful at the end because, you know, we started in like the summer. Well, we started really in March, and then COVID hit 2020. Nobody was doing anything. So then over the summer, we were kind of prepping everything, talking to investors. September, we started getting offers. We got a massive amounts of offers, which felt really good, right? Then we kind of narrowed it down to like 5-6, went through the process, ultimately ended up, you know, picking the one that we picked. But throughout the last 2 weeks, like there were so many things that have changed between the offers we had, you know, valuations, terms. So like it wasn't really until the thing was signed, like 4 a.m, the day before Thanksgiving, that we knew we have a deal done. And until that point, you're like, man, like I can literally lose everything. You know, like it's like, well, not lose, but you know, the deal can just all fall apart and the last 6 months are gone. So that was super stressful. So getting the deal done was incredible. And eventually when I got the money, like nothing's much changed. Actually.
But you did feel something after, no?
I felt, I felt relieved. I felt, you know, I would say, I definitely, there was the temporary moment of happiness when you realize like, oh man, like this is really cool.
Did you feel a little bit of stress maybe with all that cash?
Well, I started feeling stress, not immediately, but I would say probably a couple months after when I really started to think about like where I'm going to invest this money.
Yeah.
Because you realize
parking
like,
the money.
Man, like, you know, I've got all this cash. This is great, but it's a responsibility, right?
Yeah.
Now, this was 21 when inflation started to come up to like 8-9%.
Yeah.
And you're like, well, if you don't invest this money, by end of the year, it's 10% down in value, right? And so everybody was like, oh, you got to invest the money. And everything was so expensive, right? Like everything, like stocks, companies, private equity, like real estate. So I was like, well, you know what? I think something bad's going to happen. I'm just going to hold on. And I only put a little bit of money to equities. And right now I feel like the hero, you know, it's like, most of my money is in cash. It's just sitting in the bank waiting to be deployed. You know, I'm doing some stuff in like renewable energy and then a couple like private equity funds, but I'm just waiting for the right opportunity.
Yeah, because this is a journey that a lot of us go through, right? It just, there is that stress, especially when you see, I saw the electric goods.
Fact that you said a lot of us go through and anybody listening is like,
no, the stress, the people. Yeah, no, I mean the stress. Yeah.
Yeah, that is, yeah.
The stressful part is because you go and you see how luxury goods went up like 2 times than what it was. I mean,
what a shitty thing for...
It's just not a good... Like, everything went up.
Wow, now you can only buy one bag for $5,000, not two bags anymore.
Yeah, it's like there's nothing available. Everything is overpriced. Nothing... So it's like my money doesn't... And the inflation is
the
not really accurate.
Horrible,
yeah, 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 yeah. A yacht is $180,000, not $150,000 anymore.
No, but the idea is that you know that it's a representation of the inflation. And you said, well, even if they say it's 8%, it's bullshit. It's not really 8%. Because try to buy a house in the islands right now. It went from 10 to 30.
No, but so, you know what? But you know what I think is the biggest thing is for me at least, it was the anxiety of not knowing what I was doing. So like You ask me anything about logistics, fulfillment, like I'm an expert. I'll tell you everything, right? Like you can really surprise me. In investment or investing in general, I knew nothing about investing. Like I've never invested a dollar before that, right? Like I was managing the company's money in a way, right? But it was very familiar environment. I think where this threw me off a little bit is like, okay, I got all this money and now I have to get into like a whole new industry with totally different rules, totally different KPIs, totally different like everything. And try to make money in that. And I think that's what was giving me
was that like that you felt like, okay, there are other top predators. I'm not one of them.
It was, and yeah, exactly. It's like, I'm like a, you know, I'm like a little like barista in a Starbucks. Yeah, like yeah. I have no idea what I'm doing, right? Like this is kind of the level that I fell in that investment world. So like you're a rock star operator. You have a great company. You know a lot about operating a business. You walk into this new industry of like investing money and you realize you're nobody. Like you know nothing, you know nobody. So you start learning and then you realize the more you learn, the more you realize how much you don't know.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then more you realize like everybody tells you different things. Like people don't really like, you know, what everybody has interest. Different interests in mind. Yeah. And like it's really exciting but scary at the same time. Right. And so like I've gone through an interesting journey over the last year and a half. I would say I'm like on that journey to 100, maybe at 10%, like I feel like, you know, and it's I feel more comfortable now, but I still It's a long road. And it's hard to like.
And even the good ones don't really know. What bothers you is that even the really good ones, they don't always win. They don't always know. It's not like logistic that if you know, you know, and it's going to be okay. Like, yeah. But yeah, it's a challenging business. What's your, actually, I wanted, it's a side note. There was a funny story you told me about a guy that got scammed with a $5,000. How he got a call and there was someone in his company.
Yeah,
get this email. Say, hey, this is Jen. Who's a new
manager.
Oh, this
happened like three times since, by the
three
way.
Three times, really?
Yeah. I mean, it's
good for companies. Like a phishing scheme? Anyone, phishing scheme. It's good for anyone that has a company to hear this out because it does happen.
Yeah, cybersecurity exposure. Yeah, I mean, it's so basically, we would have a new employee, and like every time we have a new employee, somehow people find out their phone number. I guess it's maybe when they change it on their LinkedIn, whatever, and then they'll get a text from me saying, hey, John, you know, you're available. And they're like, oh, this is Jan. They're like, yeah, like I'm available. They all want to impress me, right? And then they're like, well, you know, I kind of need you. Like we have an issue with a customer and I'm not available right now. Like, can you run and give me some like Target gift cards for this customer? And they're like, yeah, sure. And so this guy, this was a new warehouse manager in California, went to Target, right? And then bought whatever, $500 gift cards and like scrapes them, texts them back to me, he thinking, right? And then the guy's like, oh, thank you. Like, you're so amazing. And by the way, like, can you also go to Apple Store to buy more gift cards? So this guy gets out of the Target, goes to Apple Store, buys like $2,000 of gift cards. And by the way, the reason why it's $2,000 is because they always cap it. You can't buy more than a certain amount.
For fraud.
Fraud reasons,
probably
right?
For fraud, yeah.
He goes there, buys these cards, pays. Then he goes to like Walmart and he just sends into all these places, right? He ends up basically buying $13,500 of gift cards.
Oh my God.
The only reason he didn't buy more is because he wiped out his entire debit card account, right? Like he had no more money in his account. So that's why he stopped buying the cards. And then obviously, like, you know, then when he bought all them, he was like, oh yeah, thank you. You're so good. And then like he submits a request for reimbursement, right, to the company. And we're like, what the fuck is this? And we just look at it and we're like, yeah, you just totally got scammed. Like it was a total phishing scam. You know, they just pretended from a random number to be me. And he didn't really think to question it. And it's happened. Like, I mean, it's happened a lot, but four other people actually ended up buying some gift cards.
Oh my God.
Just pretty crazy, huh?
Yeah, it's insane. It's insane. I mean, it's something that we used to get all the time. People would get emails from me. The thing with me is that if I wanted to talk to you, I would come into your desk, knock on your door, whatever office. So people knew that wouldn't be Joe. So then I had to change my email address.
You guys had a pretty big scam issue, right? Like,
oh yeah, we had a different type of scam. Yeah, so we had a scam where someone somehow got through the email through our one of the brands we worked with, and they were supposed to send us a wire. So I guess they hacked their email, and they knew that they have to send us an email. So they sent us an email in their behalf, saying, "Hey, listen, we changed our email our wire instruction." Can you send it over there? Now, I'm in the Philippines getting a call from my CFO saying, oh man, we got to get a lawyer. Can you help me? I'm like, what are you talking about? Anyway, he said, yeah, that company, they didn't send us the money. And they said that we need to go and pay them. But we did pay them. I said, wait a minute. Did you check that we actually paid him. And then he said, yeah, we did. They just changed the email address. I said, and did you check that it was actually their email? Apparently it wasn't their email. Okay, so we got scammed. Senor, you should have, did you just send a different wire instructions based on some email without calling, verifying? Well, anyway, it was, and then we got lucky. It was 17,500. We called it fast enough. We called the bank. The bank actually reversed it. And we had insurance, but it was only 17,500. The next one was 750,000 because they already got into our email system. And then they found out there was one. They actually got into one girl's email, I guess. That's how we did that. We found. So then they found out there was another email. There was another wire for 750. And then they said, hey, can you wire us? By then we already knew. So we dodged a much bigger bullet.
Something that's happened in my company, some hacker has found a way without my password, because we've checked it, to spoof my actual email.
Email, yeah. No, so that happens.
Like my not a fake email, not like a lookalike, like the exact.
That's how
email.
I got scammed by Airbnb. Yeah. It's like the craziest thing.
So like Airbnb?
So I booked, this was a long time. Well, this is like in the beginning, right? So I bought, I rented a house for New Year's for my parents, my wife's parents. Like we all were going to go to this house in the mountains, and I booked it through Airbnb, right? And then I basically get an email from, like, literally it came from Airbnb.com address. Like, it was like info@Airbnb.com. And the email had all the listing. It looked exactly like an Airbnb's email. And it said, hey, you know, thank you for, like, booking with Airbnb. Like, in order to finish this payment, because this house is in Europe, which is, like, that's what I thought. Because in Europe, like, a lot of times you just pay with a wire to pay for accommodation, hotels, whatever. This was 2012 or something. So it wasn't as uncommon. And they were like, just wire this, you know, 4,000 euros, whatever, to this bank account in the UK, by the way, which was like in Barclays Bank. So it wasn't like I was wiring it to Kenya.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh, okay, it doesn't sound that weird. So I wired them the money. This is the craziest thing. And then they sent me the confirmation. Your booking is confirmed. You know, here's like checking instructions.
They sent you a confirmation.
Everything. Like the whole thing, right?
At least they're saying.
But here's the craziest thing. Like I was supposed to arrive. This was like from December 29th. Then I was arriving on December 30th. My parents, my wife's parents, came on December 29th to that house in Austria. Drove for 10 hours, right? They get to where the house is supposed to be, the address, and they call me up and they're like, hey, there's no house here. And I'm like, wow. What do you mean there's no house? They're like, yep, there's literally, like, it's an empty lot. And I'm just like, that doesn't make any sense. And so I start looking, digging into it. I call Airbnb support. And they're like, yeah, like, we don't actually have any kind of confirmation from the seller. They didn't ever confirm that it's available. And... like, sorry. And they never gave me my money back. Like, wow. It was, but somehow that email, their email was spoofed.
Yeah.
And it wasn't, like, I don't know how people do it, but that's just.
I don't know how they do it. But thank God my team knows me well enough. Because it's always cryptic. It's like, hey, Scott, urgent, please text me back immediately. Or it's like, hey, employee, it's Scott, it's urgent, please text me back immediately.
By the way, if you were a scammer, like, isn't there a better way to do this? Like, don't be that obvious, right?
Yeah,
like,
right?
Like, the, like, you know, all these, like, yeah, misspellings.
All this, yeah, all those issues. Like, you can totally make it much more.
Believable.
Yeah, believable. Yeah.
Well, you would be very good at this, Joe.
Like, if you were amazing.
Like, if you lived in Kenya, I feel like you would have like a, you know, absolutely, like a whole rig of people and just like scam.
Lagos. Yeah.
I would
automate
next
this.
Business.
Yeah, I would have built an AI. I'm keeping him honest. I don't need any room with people. I would have had a good AI that can speak better than people.
Yeah. They have that now. They have AI writers.
Oh, yes. I'm sure. Yeah.
Yeah, it's crazy what you can do with AI now.
Yeah.
Do AI
years paint. Ago, I heard the
AI scamming. It's scary.
AI scam. Well, I mean, it just combines it. It combines AI writing with somebody who can send an email.
Oh my God! Yeah. Yeah, we get scammed.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's awesome. Getting scammed is awesome.
It's awesome.
What an experience, guys! Experience. Yeah. That's how you live your life. You just get scammed, and then awesome. Like, there's nothing else to stop you.
Listen, John, I want to thank you for coming over, taking that 44 minutes drive all the way from the islands in Miami to.
It was about like an hour and 15, but okay.
Yeah, an hour and 15. Well, sorry about that. Traffic. You know, so great seeing you.
Great seeing you, right? Too.
Yeah, and we're going to probably have you again on our podcast. You're amazing and continue to succeed.
Cool. Thank
awesome.
You.
Thanks.
Good stuff. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, man. Thank awesome. You.
I know a lot of entrepreneurs listen to this show, and NetSuite has been a huge supporter for entrepreneurs, for business owners, because there's one thing that we all know. Business is about making money, and it's about your bottom line. And the less you spend on the nuts and bolts of running your business, the more profits you keep. But these days, everything is costing more. Supplies, people, shipping. It squeezes your margins, and I've been there, juggling multiple systems for finance, inventory, you name it. Each with its own costs and its own set of headaches. That's why I made the switch to NetSuite by Oracle. It's changed our company. Think about it. NetSuite is one of the top financial systems out there. It puts your whole business on one platform, accounting, finance, the works. One data source for everyone. There's no more mismatched info. And because it's in the cloud, it slashes your IT costs. No more servers, no more updates. Just access NetSuite from anywhere. With one integrated suite, your overhead drops big time. And here's the real win. Efficiency. Everything's connected in NetSuite. Costs are ridiculous lately. Find a proven way to reduce your expenses and get better performance out of your team. It's a no-brainer, and that's what NetSuite offers. Over 37,000 companies have figured this out already. You have to join them. Right now, through to April 15th, NetSuite's got an incredible, flexible financing plan. Check it out and see the savings yourself at netsuite.com/Scott Clary. That's netsuite.com/Scott Clary. Hiring as a small business owner is a major pain. That's why LinkedIn is supporting today's episode. You need people with the right skills and experience, but finding them can take forever. It is incredibly frustrating to keep seeing candidates who just aren't a good fit, and that's why LinkedIn Jobs has been a game changer. Let me tell you a little story. We needed to hire a graphic designer, somebody with specific tech and software knowledge and the ability to truly understand our brand. And I started with all the usual job boards, and it's the same old story. Tons of irrelevant applications. No one's really matching my needs. I tried LinkedIn Jobs, and the quality of candidates was just on another level. People with impressive portfolios, relevant expertise. I finally felt like I was interviewing the right people. That's truly the power of LinkedIn's massive professional network. You're tapping into this huge pool of talent you simply wouldn't find on other sites. It's about finding those niche candidates you actually need. And with the right people in front of you, hiring becomes a breeze. Did you know that 86% of small businesses find a qualified candidate on LinkedIn Jobs within 24 hours? That is how well their system works. Honestly, do yourself a favor and try LinkedIn Jobs next time you're hiring. You can post your job for free at linkedin.com/excellence. That's linkedin.com/excellence. Terms and conditions apply, but it's definitely worth trying out. I don't know about you, but the idea of being harassed, scammed, or even worse, all because somebody found my personal information online, that's terrifying. Our political opinions, our addresses, even stuff about our families, it's out there for anyone to grab. And did you know that data brokers are allowed to sell information on over 98% of Americans? It's scary stuff. That's why I've partnered with Delete Me. I personally use Delete Me. They're a big friend of the podcast because I put myself out there online. So safety is a huge concern. It's really scary how easy it is to find someone's details and information, but DeleteMe creates a layer of protection that we all need. You tell DeleteMe what you want gone, and they make it disappear from those sketchy data broker sites. And DeleteMe doesn't stop. They constantly monitor the web to keep your information off those lists. It's like having a privacy watchdog that never sleeps. You need to take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for DeleteMe. They're giving a special discount for all Success Story podcast listeners. Get 20% off your DeleteMe plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/success and use promo code success at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/success and enter code success at checkout. joindeleteme.com/success. Hey everyone, I just want to take a second and thank the sponsor of today's episode, Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond Bourbon. Now, I don't have a lot of liquor sponsors on this show. Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond is actually one of my favorites. I've drank it for a few years now, and this is why we actually decided to work together. Heaven Hill Distillery, family-owned since 1935, is a great entrepreneur story too. So there's five brothers. They filled their first whiskey barrels back in 1935, and their legacy still lives on today. Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond is aged over 7 years. That's three more than required by the Bottled and Bond Act of 1897. This means the best quality, the best purity, and the best consistency. This is not just average bourbon. It's the winner of the double gold medals at multiple 2023 World Spirits competitions, and they've won the very prestigious Triple Still Award. It's a very big deal in the liquor and bourbon world. Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond boasts an exceptionally smooth oak flavor, while its aroma offers a sweet blend of caramel and smooth vanilla. If you love bourbon, you need to try Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond. Available nationally, look for a bottle at your local store. Heaven Hill reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely.
Think back to your last few days in the office. Did any of them leave you feeling really accomplished? Not the kind of day where you're running around like crazy, but where you've made real progress on something that matters. Because being busy doesn't always mean being productive, and I bet you we've all been there, and maybe it's time to rethink what it means to get things done. Today's episode is sponsored by Belay, and what they help you do is, instead of getting sucked into emails and to-do lists, they help you delegate tasks and focus on big goals. They can connect you with top-notch US-based talent who are ready to take on those time-consuming tasks that bog you down. Let's be real, there are way more important things you could be doing than bookkeeping or wrangling a packed inbox. They have virtual assistants to handle all of those pesky administrative tasks, or accounting professionals to take care of all your financials. But here's the best part. You don't have to waste weeks searching for the right person. Belay's personalized matching service works quickly, sometimes matching you with the right talent to take stuff off your plate in under a week. Are you ready to try a different way of working? Check out Belay's list of the top 25 things you can delegate to a virtual assistant. It might just change your business and your life. Text SUCCESS, that's SUCCESS, to 55123 to get the list and to start transforming your to-do list with Belay.